We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Studies podcast. This is episode 11, Reading the Signs. For joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Talonda Henderson about their Harry Potter scholarship, employing a variety of literary criticism perspectives, including semiotics, fat studies, and trauma theory. We'll also talk to them about what it's like to be a trans Harry Potter scholar. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we are getting a glimpse at one Harry Potter scholar's array of research questions and answers. Emily, you and I have talked a lot about how the Harry Potter novels provide rich material for literary criticism. Why do you think that is?
You know, I always come back to our recent conversation with Dr. Tyson Pugh about the many genres of Harry Potter, and I think that's part of it. I think that there's a lot going on in that quote unquote compost heap in the author's head, and I think that seeing the way all that breaks down is and talking about the way that breaks down is just creates a lot of great questions and great answers. And I love the scholarship from Talonda that we got to look at in preparation for this podcast, because there's a lot of awesome questions and answers in their work.
Right. And there's a lot of variety there, too, as you could tell from my little introduction there. So we are really delighted to have Talonda here because of, you know, I just think that really displays the rich fodder for analysis that we have with us with those seven books.
Definitely.
We are very pleased to have joining us today Talonda Henderson, a PhD student in the English department at the University of Connecticut, who particularly studies the intersections of disability, race, and adolescence in young adult literature. Talonda has published multiple Harry Potter essays, some of which we'll be talking about today. I first met Talonda at the Southwest Popular and American Culture Conference, where I've seen them present on a variety of Harry Potter topics. And I'm so excited to finally have you on the show. Talonda, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Talonda, how did you first get interested in Harry Potter scholarship?
Before I was a PhD student at UConn, I was a librarian at George Washington University. And my primary job was to support first-year writing classes in learning how to think about resources and the mechanics, but mostly the metacognition of research. And one year there was a Harry Potter class, and I was like, I'm going to be the librarian for that class. Yes, I am. Don't argue with me. And around the same time, I had put down projects from, I have three master's degrees. Okay. So my first two are in religious studies and in library science. And ooh. I had ideas from each of those that I was thinking about trying to publish. And then it had been like 10 years and I was like, I am done with these ideas. So I put them down around the same time that I was interacting with this Harry Potter class. And they were asking all of these fantastic questions. Like somebody was like, how is it that Draco grows up in an intact family, and Harry grows up in this abusive family, and Harry turns out as a sweet person, and Draco turns out as a horrible person. And I'm like, you need to look at sociology of the family. You know, like that was my job, was to point them in the direction of the disciplines and kinds of questions that would help them answer their own questions about the text. So that's kind of what's got me started thinking about, because I was in this place where I had just put down some research, and so I wanted to be doing some research, didn't know what to research, and then I was around all of this Harry Potter research, and I was like, I will research Harry Potter. So my very first research project in the Potterverse was about why Madame Pince is so useless.
I resonate with that. Yes.
She doesn't help them at all. I mean, they really should have been able to go to her and say, who is Nicholas Flamel? And she could have said, I'm not sure, but here's an encyclopedia, you know, like here's whatever. And but it would have ruined the books, right?
It's so
So
true.
that's one of the major reasons that Madame Pince is such an unhelpful character, because otherwise the books wouldn't be as suspenseful as they are.
And
You
you
know,
have to
I'm
have unhelpful adults for the children to, you know, gain some resourcefulness and to be in the
You
leadership
know,
positions.
yeah, that's very true. There were other reasons too, like the fact that the what happens in the classroom doesn't really matter in the books as much as what happens outside of the classroom. So having a librarian help in the classroom wasn't necessary, etc. So that was my first foray into Potter scholarship, and from there, I obviously you can't study the library at Hogwarts without studying Hermione, which is how I got my hands on a copy of Hermione Granger Saves the World, edited
Oh,
by Chris Bell,
I love
and
that
on the
one. It's such a great compendium.
on the back of the book, it mentions the conference in Albuquerque where you and I met, Katie. So that's how I
Right.
kind of got into like the circles of Potter scholarship beyond just my own interests.
That's great. And did you sign on to the conference and that generated more interest for you? Was the conference a part of that at all?
Yeah, so I went to the Harry Potter, the Chestnut Hill Conference in the October of 1 year, and then I went to the Albuquerque Conference in the spring of that same academic year, the next calendar year. And I was like, oh, what other questions can I ask of this? You know, like I can't quite remember what my second paper was, but then it was just a matter of like, oh, cool, what else is going on? What else is going on? So, I mean, I was a generalist as a librarian once I left theological librarianship, which is the first 3 years I did, but as a generalist, it's sort of like, oh, here's a question. I wonder what you know, Mad-Eye Moody has a peg leg and there's no elevators in all of Hogwarts. Discuss, you know? Oh, my second presentation at Albuquerque was how do you study a portrait when the people aren't always in them? Discuss, you know? And then like I think I presented on this fat studies idea at Albuquerque, which we'll get to. You know, it's just like Dudley is a nice guy after he's no longer described as fat. Discuss. You know, so it wasn't until I started looking at trauma that I was actually doing literary analysis on purpose. It was more, it started out more as these texts are fascinating to me and they have so much to say about the world. Let's, you know, discuss.
Yeah, and I think what you're suggesting here too is another reason why we keep coming back to them, which is there are some kind of unanswered questions that the texts bring up that do turn us toward other areas of study and make us think about ourselves and our own world in some ways.
I give talks at public libraries or other places just about like what does it mean to be a Harry Potter scholar? What is that even? And because people are like, why would you study Harry? And I'm like, it's like being a Shakespeare scholar 400 years early, you know?
That's right.
Because
So
Shakespeare was
true.
incredibly popular amongst the populace, and you know, all of the sexual innuendo and all of that. It's like it was not this highfalutin thing that it's made out to be now. So for me, like you have to have a question about the world or the text that the text itself doesn't answer. And then you need to have people to be in conversation with to help you interact with or answer that question. And that's what's different about scholarship than about fan fiction, for example. You may both start with a question that the text doesn't answer. What were the Marauders like when they were at Hogwarts, for example? And fan fiction could say they were like this, you know? Whereas scholarship wouldn't create texts to answer the question. It would be in conversation with other scholars. I don't know how scholarship would approach that particular, maybe wouldn't even approach that particular question, but might have questions about the Marauders map that scholarship on maps that could answer. Of
Spoken like
course,
a true research librarian, Talanda.
You know, I've been impressed with the really close textual analysis that you do in your work. And that is another source for scholarship, taking a look at the language and itself and how the language is used, and using
Absolutely.
that as source material for answering those questions.
Well, for me, that really comes from having been in seminary, to be honest. I went to seminary originally to become an ordained minister, and then I switched out and did the MA in religious studies and then did theological librarianship after getting a degree in library science. But my point is that like the whole idea of like what the text says matters. What the text says matters a whole heck of a lot, you know? So I actually used for many of my early Potter scholarship, I used an online program called the Simple Concordance Program. So I was able to go through and feed it the digital text of the novels and say, give me every place in the novel that in the series that uses the word library or librarian. And that's how I was able to come up with the conclusions that I had about Harry tends to use the library to get out of things because he would say, oh, Neville, I left my vampire essay in the library, so here's the password to the, and I'm going to go to the library. Or when he needs to leave Gryffindor common room to go and see Dumbledore to learn about Voldemort, he says, oh, I have to go to the library, is how he gets out of the conversation that he's in. So as opposed to Hermione, who's like, well, of course, that's what Hermione does. She goes to the library. When in doubt, go to the library. So I wouldn't have come to those conclusions if I had just read at the surface level. I needed to be able to pull the texts out to be able to say, I did the same thing with the fat studies essay. I looked at all of the places in all seven books where the word fat was used. And then I also pulled out words like pudgy and porky
Large.
and large to see the patterns that I discussed in that essay.
Cool. That's so great. And that's, I mean, I think that's one of the blessings of the digital world for scholars is that, you know, we can do things like that. When you're looking at your essays, there's such a wide variety, Talanda, of questions that you have. And I can see now how you've generated, you know, the variety that you have in your scholarship because you have these great questions on so many different topics. But when you look back over what you've written, do you see particular themes emerging that point to the things that are most interesting to you in the books?
No.
There's
I mean, the one major theme is Harry Potter. So, like I said, being a generalist, like I didn't come to Harry Potter as someone with a disciplinary agenda, right? Like I have an undergraduate degree in sociology. I had at that point graduate degrees in religion and library science. So my first question was about being a librarian, but I've never asked questions about religion, even though I have that background. You know, the second paper that I gave in Albuquerque was with an art historian, because we got into a conversation over dinner about what would it look like to teach art history at Hogwarts, and then it evolved from there. So I kind of was just not at the mercy of the winds, but like it's just sort of like, oh, well, I wonder what this is, and I wonder what that is. I mean, the Fast Studies paper I had wanted to do for a while. But that comes from my own experience as a fat person and as a scholar who is fat. So it's sort of like there isn't anything in the books that necessarily comes up consistently in my scholarship. Like the next thing I want to do is something on the madness of Harry Potter. Like she uses the word mad I mean, in Britain, it's mostly mad as in crazy. It's rarely mad as in angry. So it would be very easy to pull it through the concordance program and say, give me all the places where the word mad comes up,
Wow,
and
that's
then
fascinating.
come to conclusions based on that. And then, of course, you have to think of the synonyms that she would use for that. But you can get that if you look in a paragraph that uses the word mad, then it might also say, well, he's a nutter. And then you look up all the words, all the places where the word nutter comes up. So that has nothing to do with anything except that it intrigues me. It's related to disability studies, but it's not exactly the same. And it didn't come out of my interest in disability studies. It came out of my interest in the frequent use of the word in the series.
Yeah, so the series is really the thing that is the central organizing question. Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And Talanda, I'm also a generalist, like obviously with a variety of things that I do. And so I totally sympathize with that. And when I get, I feel like I've done what I want to do over here, there's this whole interesting world over there that you can look into. So I totally relate to that. So we're going to talk about a few of your essays, and I wanted to start with one that I first encountered, which is called The Statue and the Sign, The Origins and Significance of the Memorials to the Potter Family, which is an essay that won the Science Fiction and Fantasy Graduate Award at the Southwest Popular and American Culture Conference in Albuquerque in 2017. So I was fascinated by this because, to tell the truth, I had forgotten that there were memorials to the Potter family discussed in the books, or in particularly Deathly Hallows. And so lead us through this a little bit. What is the sign and what is it signifying?
So this is a paper that I wrote coming out of an idea that I had when I was living in the Washington, D.C. area. I was going to do a whole series called Mr. Potter Goes to Washington. Like, what would Harry and his friends discover behind the scenes if they ever visited Washington, D.C.? And so that's how I started thinking about, well, you have these monuments on the mall in particular, but in a lot of places all over the district. And so let's talk about the monuments and the memorials that are in the series itself. So when Harry goes, he goes to Godric's Hollow because he knows his parents are buried there. That's the memorial that he knows of. When he gets there, he finds that there's a statue magically concealed within a war memorial. And the statue is his parents, he and his parents. And so he's this like happy baby with no scar on his forehead. Like, he's probably never, that's the kind of detail that's so intriguing about the series. It's like, oh, of course, if his parents were alive, he wouldn't have had the scar yet. So that's in the town square. And then I forget if they specifically go looking for the cottage or if they happen upon it. But they being Harry and Hermione, find and are able to see the cottage that was blown apart when the curse rebounded. And when he gets there, Harry takes off a glove and touches the gate that is closed there. And Hermione's like, oh my gosh, don't open it. Don't go in there. It's not safe. And he's like, I don't need to go in there. He's as she's having this little fit, trying to keep him safe, this sign comes up from the ground, and it has this language on it about the losses of the Potter family, and that Harry remains the only person to have survived the killing curse. And this, we've left the house as a memorial to the violence that tore apart the Potter family, something like that. That's not a quote, that's a paraphrase. But what's fascinating about the sign is that the sign as memorial, as opposed to the Sassorian sign, is that people have written all over it. So they haven't obscured the text that was originally there, but all around the edges, they have like put their initials or signed their name to say they were there. There's people that have done it recently since Harry's been on the run because they're like, wherever you are, we're with you, that kind of thing. So these are moments of private grief that have been used for public purposes. I would hesitate to say co-opted, but it comes kind of close, where it's like it's not as though these things are there for the wizarding community at large. They're not there for Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Harry could, they would exist even if Harry had never come across them. As opposed to, like, anybody who knew the Potters could have gone to their graves and that could have been sufficient, but there was a larger need in the community than just these two people are dead and their son has been injured.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's, so much of that is fascinating to me because, I myself am interested in dark tourism studies, and I did a little edited volume on virtual dark tourism, and this is a perfect example of like the literary version of that, where Harry's a tourist in the town where he grew up, and he encounters this memorial that, as you said, is built for public purpose. It's supposed to sort of say something about what happened there, and the fact that the house is left as a ruin, and then you have this sign. What purpose do you think it is serving for the wizarding world at large?
So I'm not one for fan theories. I'm usually like, okay, here's what's going on in the text, and here's some scholarship to help us understand what's going on in the text. This particular paper is as close as I've gotten to. There's no direct textual evidence for what I'm about to say, but I'm pretty sure this is what was going on.
Okay, cool.
Which is to say that, and it all hinges on one word, which is also not how, like, one use of one word. It's not how I usually do scholarship, but it can crack things open sometimes. So on the sign, it doesn't say Harry is the only person to have survived the killing curse. It says that Harry remains the only person to have survived the killing curse. So to me, that says that there's been a lag in time between the death of James and Lily Potter and the erection of the sign and the decision of what the words were going to say on it. Right? So do
sure.
you see that yeah. gap that's there? And it's just like,
absolutely.
Okay, so that's the crack that opens and what's going on in there. And it's my theory that what happened is Frank and Alice Longbottom were captured and tortured. So in the fourth book, we see into Dumbledore's memories in the Pensieve, and we see this really tense trial of Karkaroff, right? And then this really light sort of, oh, look, it's Ludo Bagman. Like, he can't have done anything wrong. And thanks for your help with the match against Turkey. You know, it's just, it's very, very different. So you get the sense of, like, the mood of the wizarding community as reflected in the Wizengamot.
Yeah.
The third memory or the third trial is of the Lestranges and Barty Crouch Jr. and another wizard whose name I don't remember. The mood is back to being very stark and very like, this is not okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to imagine that the world has gone from fear of Voldemort to rejoicing that Voldemort is gone to fear of something. Right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that monuments and memorials, they don't exist solely to talk about the moment in that they are commemorating.
Right.
Right? They exist to say something to in the moment of commemoration.
Exactly.
And yeah. they're always an interpretation. It's never just like on the, you know, because it doesn't just say, you know, this is where Voldemort's name isn't even on the sign.
Right.
Right. It's like on this day, James and Lily lost their lives and the violence of the Potter family. It's like, no. There was a lot of violence on a lot of families. A lot of families were ripped apart by violence in the Voldemort regime. So this particular family needs to be remembered for this particular reason. I was thinking about when would the wizarding community have needed reassurance that the martyr narrative of James and Lily's death was the right one and that it wasn't to be celebrated and you weren't supposed to go looking for Voldemort the way that Bellatrix Lestrange and her co-conspirators had done. When would the wizarding world have needed reassurance that Voldemort had been a bad guy?
Mm-hmm.
When Frank and Alice Longbottom were captured and tortured.
Right. After they thought that Voldemort had already been defeated, and yet they realize it's lingering on. And so
yes,
there's a need for something. Yeah.
The pro-Voldemort sentiment wasn't as squished as they had thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
So the language of the Potters as martyrs really goes back into this idea of no, we are an anti-Voldemort society, and mm-hmm. we will punish anybody who is pro-Voldemort. That's my theory.
That's awesome. And I love the fan theory part of it that you bring in too, because I think it does help you. You know, one of the things also that I think makes these books so great is that there's all this backstory that you only get little glimpses of. Yep. But I totally buy that theory, Talanda. I think that that's a really excellent reading of what the Wizarding Society was likely going through in these waves after Voldemort's supposed defeat, you know, in Godric's Hollow.
Right, right. Yeah, there's one line that you have in the essay where you talk about the difference between viewing Voldemort as his death as a triumph rather than a problem that needs to be solved, you know,
right.
because
uh-huh.
it isn't his death, it's his disappearance, you know, and
right.
that's not being acknowledged by some segment of the population.
Right.
Yeah. And the role that the monument plays in reinforcing the preferred narrative.
So, Emily, you see why I love this paper.
I know. It's pushing a lot of your buttons, but it's pushing a lot of my buttons too. But I really, and you've made a couple references to it, and I really want to talk about the Fat Studies paper mm-hmm. that you wrote. And because I'll tell you that a lot of this has whizzed right by my head in terms of my reading of the 7 Harry Potter books. But then I'll tell you, I got to The Casual Vacancy. You know, and I mm-hmm. read that book and I was like, whoa, there are some negative portrayals of fat people in this book. And that it was really stark to me. And then I started thinking more about, especially with help from Lauren Camachi's mm-hmm. presentation at Chestnut Hill about physiognomy. I started thinking more about the way she uses physical attributes and in the story. And so I was really intrigued by that. So tell us, how does the series portrayal of fat characters tell audiences what they're supposed to think about characters? And you do such a great job of focusing on Dudley, Neville, and Slughorn.
Mm-hmm.
So using them and the language that surrounds them to talk about this strain in the books. So tell us, how does the series employ this term thin thinking, and why is it problematic?
So this is another example of the concordance program really shaping my thinking on this idea, because it wasn't until I ran through and discovered that Mrs. Fig calls Dudley fat after the Dementor attack, but the narrator never does. And I didn't know that until I had done the analysis. And the same for Slughorn. Nobody calls him fat or talks about his, breathing hard from running or trying to run, you know, when he is running at the head of the reinforcements from Hogsmeade at the Battle of Hogwarts in the 7th book. So thin thinking is the assumption that being thin is better than being fat, and that everything to do with being fat is bad and unhealthy in particular is really, you know, people are like, oh, but I'm worried about your health. And it's like, leave me alone, concern mm-hmm. troll. But because there is a study done a while back that found that you could have two groups of people, a control group of people who were trying to diet and lose weight, and a group of people, the experimental group, were given ways to pay attention to certain health metrics like blood pressure or cholesterol, but were not directly trying to lose weight. And after 2 years, the health metrics of the not trying to lose weight group were better and had stayed better. But the health metrics of the trying to lose weight group had not stayed better, and they had gained the weight back. So this idea that health and weight are inextricably bound is just not true. It's just
mm-hmm.
not true. It's just, it isn't in anybody's financial best interest to explore that any further.
Right.
Right.
And I think you were talking about in this paper too, thin thinking is almost reflexive. So if nobody mentions somebody's size, you just
think that they're thin. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of, you could also talk about white thinking if you wanted to, in terms of if you don't describe the racial characteristics of a character, they are assumed to be white. So if you don't describe them, what's the default? Like if you just say, oh, someone crossed the street, you're probably thinking of a dude because that's how, you know, I didn't say their gender, but it's, you know, the white, thin, male, cisgender.
It's a default.
You know, so thin thinking is always problematic. But in the story in particular, what happens is that you have these three characters who are described as fat early in the series or early when we meet them. So Dudley in the first book, Neville in the first book, Horace Slughorn when we first meet him at the beginning of the sixth book. And they're described in problematic ways. Dudley is a bully. Neville is a bumbling oaf. Slughorn is morally ambiguous, right? So Neville is the only one who is clearly on Harry's side, but that's not helping anybody in the first five books because he's, you know, he's likely to blow. Well, no, he's not the one who blows things up, but he's not very good at magic.
He's a mess too. Always forgetting things and bullied by others. And
exactly. So him being on Harry's side isn't very helpful. And these other two are either definitely against Harry in Dudley's case or ambiguous. Leaning towards, leaning away from Harry because it seemed to be safer in Slughorn's case. And as their narratives progress, they all move closer to either being on Harry's side or being helpful on Harry's side. So Dudley says, I don't think you're a waste of space. You know, Slughorn comes back to fight on the side of the Hogwarts defenders. Neville chops off the head of Nagini, actually does something useful. In each case, when they do the activity that signals their usefulness or at least alliance to Harry and his cause, the word fat disappears. So none of them are described as having lost weight, right? So it's not that Dudley becomes rail thin. It's not that Slughorn loses his enormous belly, you know. It's like there's no particular, like, now that Slughorn is thin, he thinks Harry is great, you know. It's not that obvious. But once he's on Harry's side, he's not described as fat or as wheezing, right? So that then leaves space for reinterpretation of his body, because the descriptions of his body are absent.
So you can think them thin.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and you pointed out, you go into the most depth with Dudley because there's much more, you know, there's much more kind of information in the text on Dudley and the body image issues. And you talk about how, you know, in what I think it's the fifth book, that, you know, it's mentioned that he's been lifting weights and he's gotten very muscly. Yes. So it's like this re-spin of Dudley as a character. And then that's when, you know, he starts to make this transition. It's kind of the root of the transition that he makes that ends up, you know, in the seventh book with him saying, you know, I don't think you're a waste of space. And he shakes his hand and acts, you know, like cousinly toward him, you know.
Right. But that cousinly feeling comes because Harry saved his life.
Right.
From, or his soul, if you want to be picky, from the dementia, of course. But Harry doesn't save Dudley until after Dudley is a weightlifting and dieting Dudley.
It's interesting.
You talked about how Neville Longbottom in the movies, that actor, actually, they made him wear a fat suit at a certain point because he had started to kind of like stretch out. If anybody who's had kids know that they plump up and then they stretch out. And that this was an intentional choice on the part of the directors when you're not in a text and you're in a movie that's very visual.
Yeah. So from the third movie to the seventh movie, Neville was in a fat suit. They put little pieces of plastic behind his ears to make them stick out. They had him sign, they offered him a contract, which he agreed to, not to get his teeth fixed until after the movies were done, and then Warner Brothers would pay for it so that Neville would have these irregular looking teeth and just basically look like a fool, a big fat fumbling fool. And then they read, you know, the text of the seventh book, and they're like, crap, we can't have a fat kid chop off the head of Nagini. So they, I mean, this is me supposing, I don't have that in a transcript, but, you know, when it comes time for Neville to step into the role he may have had if his, well, the role of the chosen one that he came so close to when Voldemort chose to attack Harry and his family, when it's time for Neville to chop off the head of Nagini, it's time for him to be fit, because heroes are, and even fit is problematic, because it's like fit what, you know? It is time for him to have a six pack that we don't get to see, because heroes are physically within the parameters of thin. And there's a thing on a trend on online, a word, you know, to long bottom is actually a phrase that you can find in the Urban Dictionary.
And wow.
It means to go from germ strain cold to dragon fire hot in a very short amount of time.
Yeah. It's the ugly duckling thing.
Yep. The ugly duckling thing. And it's based on a visual fiction. If they had filmed Neville, if they had filmed Matthew Lewis as Neville in the body that he had with no intervention, then there wouldn't be this phenomenon of long bottoming, because he would have just gradually.
He just grew up. Oh yeah. It's so important. I think the thing that you bring out in the essay that was really, frankly, very helpful and broadened my perspective is this idea that thin thinking is about making a moral judgment.
Yes.
On thinness versus fatness.
Yes.
Which is not, you know, really not appropriate in most cases, or maybe even all cases. Yes. You know, I mean,
there's never, I would say in any case, to say that thin is morally better than fat is not based in anything other than assumptions. And people do this all the time. They'd be like, oh, I'd love to have a cookie, but I need to be good today. Or, you know, it's just like, good people eat cookies.
Right. I love that. Could that be my motto?
People eat cookies. I always just say, I'm saving all my calories for wine.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, but if you were to say something like, oh, I'm going to be naughty later and have some wine, that would fit into this moral judgment that we're talking about. You know, morality and body size are two unlinked things.
Right.
Fat is a neutral description of body size as a natural variation in human existence.
Right.
So anybody who's interested in reading this essay, it is in the anthology Inside the World of Harry Potter, which is edited by Dr. Christopher Bell. And it's one of his volumes, which those are always full of so many cool essays. And you have another essay coming in an anthology that is not out yet, but hopefully will be soon, edited by Cecilia Conchar-Farr, called Open at the Close, which is entirely literary analyses of Harry Potter, showing its literary richness. And you wrote for that volume an essay on how the series expresses Harry's trauma, particularly in regard to the scene at King's Cross Station at the end of Deathly Hallows, which you do a pretty deep reading of, like Emily was talking about before. So, Talanda, how does trauma distort Harry's sense of time, space, and embodiment? And then what strategies does the series pose to readers who may be dealing with their own traumas?
The earliest moment where we see what scholars call peritraumatic dissociation. So we're used to the phrase post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's not post-traumatic, it's peritraumatic. It's in the midst of the trauma that this dissociation happens. So peritraumatic dissociation happens as early as book four, when the books really shift into, I mean, the whole scene in the graveyard is very dark, but the idea that there's death on screen when Cedric Diggory dies is one of the watershed moments of the change in the books, from these kind of lighthearted children's books into more deeper YA books, if you will. And when Cedric dies, Harry looks into his eyes, into his dead classmate's eyes, for a moment, for a second that contained an eternity. And I just love that phrase because it's so, I think a lot of people know what that feels like when you don't, Harry doesn't have time to process the death of his classmate. He's immediately pulled into, you know, the grave and the rebirth and the Death Eaters and all of that. He has no time, but death is so final that just, you know, oh, Cedric's dead. Okay, next is not going to cut it. So his sense of time is thrown off. Same thing when Sirius goes through the veil in the Department of Mysteries. It took Sirius an age to fall. It's like, no, he didn't. But yes, it did. You know, like the laws of gravity didn't change, but the reality through trauma changed for Harry. In King's Cross, meaning the chapter called King's Cross, there's a lot going on in that chapter. And it really starts with this idea that Harry isn't even sure that he exists. And he is the linchpin of the entire series. I mean, the whole every book is called Harry Potter and the something, right? So if he doesn't exist, then the story doesn't exist. Then what are we reading? Like, it really is this, I mean, an ontological distortion. Ontology is the study of being. So like, who are you? You know, what is this at its very core? And when Harry isn't sure that he exists, that's a very extreme dissociation, right? And when he's in that space, he's like, he thought about it for a long time, or maybe no time at all, you know, is a paraphrase. Or the space around him is all in mist. Like, there's just, it's all very fuzzy, and it gets less and less fuzzy as the chapter goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that the space provides what Harry needs. You know, it provides robes when he realizes he's not alone and decides he doesn't want to be naked, right? And when he starts to wonder if he should try to help the piece of Voldemort's soul that's making this really obnoxious noise, he needs a conversation partner to help him talk through whether or not he should and ultimately even can help this piece of Voldemort's soul. And then Dumbledore appears. Right. So there's a moment, I think, where Harry wonders if he's in some kind of room of requirement, because it's just like, oh, you need something. There it is. But for Harry, what he needs, I was just rereading this essay myself. And one of the things that I point out is that at the end of almost every book, right, first five books, Dumbledore is like, let's sit down and talk about what's happened to you this year, and especially in the last 24 hours.
Right.
You know, Dumbledore explains all.
He insists that Harry relive his trauma from the graveyard, even though Sirius would rather just put him to sleep. You know, it's really Dumbledore pushing the need for a conversation. I will open the door after I explain to you why you should be more mad at me for Sirius's death than you already are. That kind of thing. But in the chapter called King's Cross, Harry is the one who starts the conversation. And Harry is the one who needs the conversation. And he, there are a lot of moments when Dumbledore says something like, well, you know what happened. And then Harry fills in the blanks. So what I'm getting at is not that Dumbledore isn't actually there, but that the Dumbledore in King's Cross is a version of Harry that Harry needs in order to talk through everything that has happened since he met Dumbledore, but particularly in the last like 6 months or so. You know, Dumbledore talks about his relationship with Grindelwald, but it's stuff that Harry could have come to his own conclusion about based on what he knew from Aberforth.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So there's no new information in the King's Cross chapter the way that there is like at the end of book five. Oh, there was a prophecy. Did I not tell you that? You know, there's no...
Right. It's more affirmation. Yeah.
It's much more affirmation than information. And so what I think people can take away from this is that telling the story of trauma is part of how you deal with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And that having a conversation partner is incredibly important. One of the things that I argue in that chapter is that Harry never would have been able to defeat Voldemort if he hadn't had the time and space to create a coherent narrative out of everything that he already knew and then learned within the previous 24 hours about what was going on. Having a place where you can really understand what's happened and also having a conversation partner to talk through. Now, you're not always going to be able to create a version of yourself to do that. You know, there's actually a Dumbledore there. There's a moment when Harry is glad to be able to touch Dumbledore. It's not just smoke and mirrors. And, you know, even if it is all in Harry's head, who's to say that it's not real, right? So I would suggest that, you know, people listening or anybody who is dealing with their own trauma, find another person to be in conversation with. Mm-hmm. You know, a therapist, a friend, a spiritual advisor, somebody to just narrate the story of the trauma and what it means and what maybe can be done, not necessarily to redress the trauma from the past, but how can I move forward with this? That's what I would say.
Well, I found that so powerful, and I really appreciate your perspective, because of course we have heard about post-traumatic stress disorder and some of the characters, but Harry does not just have traumas in his past. He's got, right. He gets new traumas every year, you know?
Yeah.
And how is he making it through that? And, mm-hmm. you know, the way that you talk about the physical responses to the trauma that's happening, and particularly death that's happening right in front of his eyes, but also the ability to create a narrative. And I truly believe that to be human is to be a person of story,
yep.
and that stories mm-hmm. play this incredibly important role in our understanding of ourselves and the world and our relationship to the world. And that just encapsulates that perfectly. And what a cool reading of that chapter.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense otherwise. I mean, not mm-hmm. to say that my reading is the only reading that makes any sense ever. but that
isn't that what it means to be a scholar? Pontificating.
But that particular chapter is so beyond the pale of mm-hmm. anything else that's in the book.
Yeah.
In the series, you know, usually Harry did this, Harry said this, Harry went here and sat there and talked to somebody. And then to start off with, Harry wasn't sure if he existed, you know, it's just like...
Right, yeah, well, and yeah, it definitely emphasizes the interiority that the whole series has emphasized, but all of a sudden it becomes the most real thing, you know,
yeah.
is that interior experience. And mm-hmm. and that's a really hopeful message, I think, for a lot of people to understand that what's going on inside our heads is actually really real, you know,
yep.
And not just something to be dismissed or to mm-hmm. just power through. But mm-hmm. So Talanda, thinking back about what you said earlier about what are kind of the central themes, and you're kind of like, nope, it's just I'm looking at this text, you know. And I mean, I'm obviously, I love that, because I feel like I can identify with that. But Tell us, though, about the fact that you're non-binary trans and we're living in 2021. So what is it like to be a non-binary trans Harry Potter scholar today?
Well, it's a lot easier than this time last year. Although, you know, like within this time last year, within about 2 weeks, it all just started to crumble. Summer of 2020 was a very difficult time to be a transgender Harry Potter fan and scholar because the author just came out with this virulently transphobic, anti-transgender language. So to back up, I stopped saying her name in the December of 2019. Not because I think it will harm her. She will probably never know that I don't say her name. But because it protects me, it puts a bubble around me. I'm not centering her when I'm talking about her. When she came out in on the side of a woman named Maya Forstarter, it was very upsetting. There had been indications previously, like she would like or she would follow an account on Twitter, and that account was known to be transphobic. And then her PR people would be like, oh, that was just a fat thumb middle age moment. She didn't mean to do that. You know, but this was Maya Forstarter had been to court in England over the fact that her contract was not renewed at her job. Because she would consistently misgender people in her workplace, meaning that you would have a trans woman and Maya would just say he instead of she. It's a very violent thing to do to a person, especially if it's consistent, persistent, and just never ending. So Forstarter went to court to say, this is protected speech. It's free speech for me to call these people what I choose to call them. And the court came back and said, no, it's hate speech. It's not protected speech. You don't get to do that. And we're not going to intervene in your labor situation. You know, your employer had every right not to rehire you because you were creating a hostile workplace. And I only know about any of this because She Who Must Not Be Named tweeted that she was on Maya's side. I stand with Maya.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, then how are we gonna reconcile this, right? And then, so that was in December of 2019. And in June of 2020, the WHO posted a tweet about people who menstruate. Which is like some people would be like, wait, what? What do you mean people who menstruate? It's like, if you've ever heard somebody say pregnant people, you know, birthing individual, you know, it's like not everybody with that set of reproductive organs is female, but don't tell that to, you know, who. she gets on Twitter. And it's like, there's a word for people who menstruate. What is that word? And then she goes through a couple of misspellings of woman as though she's trying to remember, rack her brain and remember what this word is. And people just piled on her for being transphobic, and she doubled down. And right. She published a screed on her website saying that she wasn't being transphobic, that this is what was actually going on, that this, that, and the other. I wrote an essay that is still in the publication pipeline. And in order to write the essay, I came to the point where I had to read her essay. I don't recommend it.
It's just, there's a lot of bad research in there, yeah. And bad it's rhetoric. A lot of fearfulness, I think.
Yes, yeah. Unacknowledged fearfulness on her part.
And it's very gaslighty and brainwashy. Like, I had to go and be on Facebook and, you know, go to YouTube and just be like, she's transphobic, right? She's not being nice, right? Like, because it was just, I mean, she has a way with words. Otherwise, we wouldn't know she existed. And then it felt like every other week for that whole summer, something else transphobic would happen in relation to her. She would, you know, oh, there's a new book coming out, and it's, you know, in the under her pseudonym in the mystery series, and it's men who dress up as women so that they can gain access to women-only spaces and kill women. It's like, seriously? It's difficult because I don't want to center her in my life or research. And so not saying her name, not using it in my writing is one way of doing that. The trauma essay I had the opportunity to go through after it had been through peer review and take all the references of, to her name out of the essay and then write in a little coda about why I had done that, you know? It's really hard because, like, I'm working with Cecilia Contrafar on an Approaches to Teaching Harry Potter MLA volume. And we're missing a couple of types of teaching and a couple of, like, approaches. And ordinarily, I would just go to a couple of Facebook groups that I'm in and be like, hey, I'm working on this project. Have you thought about this? Do you have any ideas? Do you want to be part of this, you know, this collection? But I saw a post, I don't even remember when, it might have been 6 months ago. Somebody was like, yeah, I'm teaching Harry Potter in the fall and I'm trying to figure out the best way to do that. And they got piled on and everybody was like, maybe just don't. So it's like, how do I justify being involved in a project about Harry Potter when she's so obnoxious?
And it does feel like, it keeps coming.
Yeah.
Like you never get past it.
She won't.
Where you're like,
up.
Yeah, death of the author is problematic here because she won't shut up.
It's true. And not only that, but there's trans exclusionary elements in the text itself. So, for example, what does Dumbledore call the son of Moroby Gaunt?
Tom.
Tom is his dead name. Tom is the name that he was given at birth that he rejected and he claimed a different name and Dumbledore refuses to use that different name. That's not okay.
If I can jump in on that,
mm-hmm.
what that was a mind-blowing kind of when you pointed that out, it was kind of mind-blowing to me because she's also associating having a dead name with the worst possible life form.
Yep.
And that's the part that kind of gives me the willies.
Only people who are evil would change their name as opposed to having a nickname, as opposed to keeping their own name.
Right.
Their own name. Even just that phrase. We were talking about thin thinking being woven in the culture. Well, cisgender thinking is woven in the culture.
Yeah.
I mean, their own name. Of course, Voldemort is his own name. Just like Caitlin is her name. Just like Elliot is his name, meaning Jenner and Paige. You don't have to like them. I think Caitlin Jenner's politics are awful. But I will insist that you not misgender her.
Yeah, it's again, it's that it's that imposition of a moral judgment. It's that assignment of moral value in a situation. Like, I remember, this is a random example, but I remember when I was pregnant with my son, people were like, we found out his gender at 20 weeks because we wanted to know. And I was being like, people were assigning a more, they were like, oh, and then somebody else would say, oh no, we're going to wait and be surprised at the birth. And everyone's like, oh, good for you. And I was like, what is this moral judgment?
Oh yeah. That's ridiculous.
I don't get why being surprised. Oh, well, we like being surprised. I'm like, you can have your surprise at 20 weeks or at 40 weeks. There's no difference morally to it. What is wrong?
And the other thing is that some people are like, oh, gender disappointment. And it's like, you're not actually finding out the child's gender at 20 or 40 weeks. You're finding out the configuration of their private parts.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And their gender, you know, I have this thing about, like, you know, just being like, oh, is it a boy or a girl? We don't know yet. They haven't told us.
Yeah. That's probably the right response.
Yeah. Except that's a moral judgment too. So,
well, right. I mean, I think what you're doing is really important because you're encouraging us to think, to not just take these for granted, you know, that it's okay to put these moral impositions on a text or on a person or on a story, but rather to examine them. And isn't that what we're all about, you know?
It should be.
Moral judgment should be. No, I'm sorry.
I'm okay being pegged as someone who has a moral judgment about whether we should be inquisitive about the world around us.
Yeah. Okay. Me too.
Well, and I think so much of what the Harry Potter books are about go contrary to all the stuff that came out last summer. I just think
she taught us to hate.
It's really against the major themes of the Harry Potter books. And so that's one of the reasons I think it's okay to still teach it. And especially if you can point out that, you know, she has these areas where she has her own unconscious, like Death Eater type ways of being that she just isn't conscious of. And I also think like that makes me think about myself as well. I always try to think like it's not like only other people have blind spots. Like I've got to examine things that I'm unconsciously behaving in that way toward. And so I think there does continue to be some value. Do you think, Talanda, do you think that you'll continue to do Harry Potter scholarship? You said you were feeling a little conflicted about this latest position. Do you think you'll do some Harry Potter things yourself?
Well, I'm not sure, because Harry Potter is why I am getting a PhD in literature. There are still things about the text that I want to research and know more about. Like I said before about mad studies in Harry Potter. Uh-huh. I think that I really want to write that paper. I've always wanted to, or I had, maybe past tense, always wanted to teach a Harry Potter class. And now I'm not sure that I ever will, because I'm not sure how to say, don't buy the books, but come and take this class, you know? And I don't want to put students in a position where they feel they have to either knowingly or once they get into the class, or, you know, unknowingly or however, that they're feeding her bank account, you know, beyond the, you know, this is centering a text that is now problematic and blah, blah, blah. It's like, what does it mean to put 7 books on a syllabus? How do you tell students that you're not putting the books on the syllabus in advance? You know, it's like in the course description, you're expected to have already read these books, but don't buy them. Like, that's just complicated to me.
It's complicated now, yeah.
So I honestly don't know what my relationship to Potter scholarship is going to be in the future. I have so many other things. I'm really glad that when I decided to do a PhD in English and in children's literature, children's and young adult literature, I decided I wasn't going to do a Potter dissertation. And I'm very glad for that, because that would be even more devastating if I had been planning to do a Potter dissertation and then all of this happened and it's like, rawr, how am I going to do that? My interests are different. I mentioned about, you know, there's no elevators at Hogwarts. That got me into disability studies. And look, thinking about disability studies in Harry Potter, you really need to think about Squibs more than Mad-Eye Moody.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
Because they are born into a society that revolves around a set of abilities that they don't have. And that got me into disability studies. And that's where my major scholarly interest is at the moment. And now also race and disability in young adult literature. I have my plate full of other types of ideas, but I don't know that I want to. I don't know in which situation she wins. If I keep talking about her texts, or if I stop talking about her texts, and I don't want her to win. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So just because you're saying that you have a lot of other things that you're looking into, do you have any like other book recommendations that you would give to our listeners? Things that you think are you know, doing some interesting things in those intersections of race and disability particularly?
There's a book called Who Put This Song On by Morgan Parker. And what's funny is that the protagonist's name is Morgan Parker. So that's its own paper. But what I was looking at is how Morgan's clinical depression is triggered by and exacerbated by the racism that she encounters as a Black student in a predominantly white school. One is informing the other. They don't just happen to both be true. They're actually, one is springboarding the other one. There's a fabulous book called Marcello in the Real World by I want to say by Francis Stork. And it is about a young man who, he's not diagnosed within the pages of the text. A lot of reviews will name him as autistic. But that in itself is problematic because the text doesn't diagnose him. So who the heck are you?
right.
But he starts off, when we meet him, he goes to a special school, and then his father is like, no, I want you to work at my law firm over the summer so that we can see you in the real world, Marcelo in the real world. And then that, you know, hijinks ensue. And one is called Out of My Mind by Sharon Draper. It's mm-hmm. about a 10-year-old girl with cerebral palsy and what happens at her school when she gets not only a motorized wheelchair, but she also gets a talking computer because she doesn't speak. But she gets a computer that she can program to say things for her, and it changes everything.
Mm-hmm. My son actually read that one in fourth grade this year.
Yeah. Yeah. And that one is interesting because it's, again, this white thinking idea. There's no description of anybody's race in the book, but there are people who will insist that Melody, the main character, is Black because the author is Black and because her little sister is described as having a copper skin tone. Huh. So is she Black? Is she white? Like, I think she's racially ambiguous. I think that's the clearest thing that you can say.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The other book that I would recommend is called Accidents of Nature by Harriet McBride Johnson. And it's really very worldview changing. It's about a girl who's about to go into her senior year of high school in 1970. And she spends a week in that summer before her last year of high school. She spends a week at a cross disability summer camp. So it's not just all people who have cerebral palsy like she does. There's deaf campers, there's blind campers, there's campers with developmental disabilities, that there's just a wide range. And she goes from being the kind of kid who's proud to have been on telethons like Jerry's Kids to understanding how problematic those telethons are and participating in a reverse telethon where quote unquote normal people need help to become more disabled. It's amazing.
That's cool.
I love it.
It's amazing. It's a really good book by an activist who people should know about.
Well, that's great. Okay, listeners, you have your list for the library or Amazon. Well, thank you so much. That brings us to the end of our episode today. Thanks so much to Londa Henderson for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
What a great conversation.
Yeah.
I'm going to end this episode with that classic moment from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which we have referenced some in this episode. It's when Harry asks Dumbledore in the limbo of King's Cross Station, "Is this real? Or has this been happening inside my head?" Dumbledore beamed at him, and his voice sounded loud and strong in Harry's ears, even though the bright mist was descending again, obscuring his figure. "Of course it's happening inside your head, Harry. But why on earth should that mean that it is not real?"
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.